the local tribal court must be assured that it may take lawful, immediate action against the abuser, regardless of tribal membership.
Making the case in Congress for more tribal authority in Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 2nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, rural districts recruit teachers in Seattle.
We get a lot of questions about, is it really dark for 6 months, you know, and we're like, no.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
The U.S. Senate Indian Affairs Committee today looked at a raft of bills aimed at improving the safety of Native American communities, including Alaska Native villages. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, a bill that would strengthen Alaska tribal courts and tribal law enforcement drew no opposition at the hearing, but the bill is likely to become more controversial.
Natasha Singh, general counsel for Tanana Chiefs Conference and also a tribal judge in Stevens Village, told an anecdote to illustrate the problem. Last summer, she was in a village when an intoxicated man tried to sexually assault a 13-year-old girl. Village leaders called the state troopers but were told they couldn't respond. Singh says this is at least the third such attempt by the same man.
Now, this man is currently still in the village. He regularly drinks. And the community, the women and children, have little protection from this individual. Do not allow this man to continue to terrorize his tribe.
A bill sponsored by Alaska Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski aims to improve the delivery of justice in villages. It would repeal the exclusion of most of Alaska from a law called the Violence Against Women Act. The Alaska Safe Villages and Families Act also encourages the state of Alaska to sign agreements with the tribes to enforce state law and deal with drug and alcohol offenses. Singh says TCC and the state are working on agreements to do that already. She says the bill should go further and provide federal recognition of the tribe's authority to deal on its own with local domestic violence and sexual assault, as well as drug and alcohol offenses, even when the accused is not part of the tribe.
What I'd like to tell you today is that if a woman in a village is the subject of domestic violence, the local tribal court must be assured that it may take lawful, immediate action against the abuser, regardless of tribal membership.
A TCC proposal, endorsed by other Native groups, calls for adding an Alaska tribal law project to the bill to recognize that kind of authority. Singh says the tribes would have civil jurisdiction only unless the state agrees to more. And that's highly unlikely, at least while Sean Parnell is governor. The head of the governor's Washington, D.C. office, Kip Knutson, declined to be interviewed for this story, but said Parnell's response was reflected in a 2011 letter detailing the state's response to a similar bill. In it, then-Attorney General John Burns suggested the bill was aimed at advancing tribal sovereignty rather than law enforcement. He also objected to what he said would be the dividing of Alaska into multiple jurisdictions. At the hearing, Senator Begich told Singh he was open to adding the tribal law project to the bill.
You need some assistance from the federal government so you can create some additional tools in the toolbox for justice within your own communities. Is that a fair statement?
Yes.
In a letter to Parnell last week, Begich said the public safety problem in Alaska is so severe it warrants an all-of-the-above approach. Such an approach, though, might cost him a co-sponsor. Senator Lisa Murkowski said at the hearing she wants to pursue funding and training for Alaska's tribal courts, but her spokesman Matt Felling says Murkowski has opposed previous proposals to extend Alaska tribal jurisdiction over non-members of the tribe. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Between a contested Senate primary and a mess of ballot questions, the August primary election is expected to be particularly lively. But a set of unusual circumstances and odd timing has the potential to push all but one of the citizen measures to the November general election if the legislature gavels out late. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
Since the early weeks of the session, legislative leadership has been emphatic that they plan to gavel out early. Here's House Speaker Mike Chenault.
There's a number of us that don't think that Juneau is the place to be on Easter Sunday.
And Senate President Charlie Huggins.
Let's get out of here before Easter.
An early close to the session lets lawmakers and staff enjoy egg hunts, family meals, and religious services. It also avoids a major ballot shuffle. Here's the deal. The Alaska Constitution stipulates that 120 days need to pass after a legislative session before a citizen's initiative can go to a vote. The idea is to give lawmakers a chance to address ballot questions through the legislative process. Ever since the legislature switched to shorter sessions, all initiatives have ended up on the August ballot with plenty of time to spare before they would be kicked to the next race. This year is a little different.
There's not a lot of wiggle room there.
Libby Bacalar is an assistant attorney general, and she specializes in election issues. She says if you look at a calendar, there are exactly 120 days between the April adjournment date and the August primary.
I guess without getting, you know, too close into the granular details of it, I would say if it comes to pass that the legislature does not adjourn on time, we'll have to evaluate the state of the ballot at that point.
So if the legislature goes even a minute beyond their scheduled closure, there's a legal argument that initiatives on marijuana, the minimum wage, and the proposed Pebble Mine should be put off until November. But Bacalar says a referendum repealing a law that caps the tax rate on North Slope oil at 35% would not get moved. As if the rules governing elections were not complicated enough, the Constitution differentiates between initiatives, which create laws, and referenda, which veto them.
The referendum, the Senate Bill 21 referendum, will be on the primary ballot no matter what.
So what does this all mean, aside from a potential headache for the Division of Elections? Well, if you're looking at a tight race, it could mean a lot.
Got the initiative blues.
While John Bitney would prefer to be known for his musical stylings, he makes his living doing political work. Back in 2010, he managed Lisa Murkowski's Senate campaign, and he knows firsthand how ballot questions can shape other races.
Well, in the 2010 primary, in addition, of course, to the U.S. Senate race, there was an initiative on the ballot that required parental consent for teenage girls to go get an abortion procedure.
Even though Murkowski supported the parental notification initiative, her opponent Joe Miller took a more conservative stance on abortion issues. Miller aligned himself with groups like Alaska Right to Life, which were already encouraging people to go out and vote for the initiative.
It really drove them to the polls. If they were in favor of it, they felt very strongly in favor of it, and therefore it was a very high likelihood that they would show up on election day and cast a ballot.
In a major upset, Miller ended up beating an incumbent senator by just 2,000 votes. While Murkowski ultimately saved her seat through a write-in campaign, Bitney thinks that may have been avoided if the ballot composition had been different.
In hindsight, I think we should have probably paid a little closer attention to that issue going in.
This year, campaigners for and against the oil tax referendum are definitely paying attention to where the initiatives end up. Renee Limoges handles communications for the Alaska Support Industry Alliance, a trade association that opposes the referendum. She says she'll be watching the scheduling of the initiatives because of how they might affect turnout.
Definitely. I mean, yeah, they initiatives do bring people to the polls, and we've got quite a varying number of them. We watch that, and we're going to pay attention to that.
Referendum supporters also think the initiatives will drive voters, and that those voters will be sympathetic to their cause. Ray Metcalf is one of the organizers behind Vote Yes, Repeal the Giveaway, and a former legislator. He says if the legislature gavels out late, it could be a blow to the repeal campaign.
Oh, we'll cry foul. of course.
But Metcalf says there's a wrinkle. Right now, Republicans, who largely support the new oil tax law, are effectively in charge of adjournment because of their majority status. The Republican Party is also invested in beating Democratic incumbent Mark Begich in the Senate race, in keeping control of the governor's mansion, and maintaining dominance in the legislature. Metcalf thinks having initiatives that are seen as attracting more liberal-minded voters would not help those goals in the general election.
They probably are on a little bit of the horns of the dilemma, because you're going to have more Democrats elected if those three initiatives are on the November ballot.
For their part, leadership in the legislature has said they do not want to wrestle with that dilemma. Some members have said they do not want to get involved in anything voters might perceive as electioneering. After all, there's a lot of work to do between now and the end of session. And there's not extra time for political gamesmanship if people want to get out early. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new solution for getting Accutane residents to their airport.
If what we've seen in the last day and a half is any sign of what's to come, I think we'll be fine.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
For school districts in rural Alaska, this is prime recruiting season. Next week, they'll hold a job fair in downtown Anchorage, looking for teachers to fill hundreds of openings statewide. But they're also looking outside the 49th state. Ed Ronco reports from Seattle.
Inside a hotel across the street from SeaTac Airport, Patrick Garrett sits wearing a pressed suit, holding copies of his resume.
I am certified to teach social studies. My background, I'm new to the profession.
He's been substitute teaching in the Seattle area where he lives. Like so many people in this room right now, he hopes his next job is further north.
I know there's opportunity to be had in Alaska, and history jobs, social studies jobs are a little hard to come by everywhere, so I'm broadening my opportunities.
Garrett makes his way around the room, talking with superintendents and principals who are standing behind tables representing 17 Alaska school districts. One of them is the North Slope Borough School District. 11 schools, 2,000 students, 400 certified teachers scattered across an area bigger than Utah. Seriously, if this school district was a state, it'd be the 10th largest in the nation. Karen Russell is Human Resources Director for North Slope Schools.
We get a lot of questions about, is it really dark for 6 months, you know, and we're like, no, but the sun does go down below the horizon for 65 days, and then, you know, I just try to do a lot of talking and convincing about the positives of life on the North Slope and that our North Slope kids deserve good quality educators.
Russell's table includes small, squishy foam polar bears imprinted with the district's contact information. As the applicants try to put their best foot forward with school officials, the school districts are also trying to make a good impression on the applicants.
Building a brand new middle school right now.
Oh, okay.
And that's in the construction process.
Over at the table for Valdez City Schools, middle school principal Rod Morrison is talking to a prospective teacher.
We get a lot of snow. Are you okay with snow?
Yes. So
the applicant calls the town Valdez, sort of a job fair party foul. But Morrison goes on with his presentation, highlighting the outdoor opportunities in Valdez and its high rate of funding, about $27,000 per student. Tony McFadden, manager of Alaska Teacher Placement, says this blend of the basic and the complex is actually a typical conversation at a lower 48 job fair.
We have the full range. We have people that really know what's going on, and we have people that don't understand that the road system does not expand the whole state. And they say, what do you mean there isn't a road? I can't drive.
McFadden acts as sort of a matchmaker between school districts and prospective teachers.
We want good matches. We want educators going into communities eyes wide open, knowing what they're getting into and embracing it. And that makes a better experience for our teachers, and it makes a much better experience for our children.
So if you want candidates who know what they're getting into, who know Alaska, why not look in Alaska? McFadden says they do. But Alaska needs more teachers than it can produce.
The problem is, while we might have teachers that are very willing to stay in Fairbanks if they went to UAF or stay in Anchorage if they went to UAA, finding people who are willing and excited to go to our rural communities is really more of a challenge.
Which brings me back to Patrick Garrett, the Seattle resident who's hoping to teach social studies or history in Alaska. Does he know what he's getting into?
Adventure, thrill-seeking. Naturally. No.
Okay, so he's kidding. He's done his homework. And he says he's still interested.
I have two young daughters, and my wife and I are in a position where we need to look for full-time employment. So we have charm, we'll travel, you know?
You're on the same page.
Exactly.
It's not like you went to the Alaska job fair today, really?
Yeah, no, okay. No. She was pushing me out the door.
Garrett mentions afterward that he got a few leads and is waiting to hear what comes next, if anything. The best case scenario is a social studies teaching job in the last frontier. At worst, Garrett says he got some good practice for future interviews. This is Ed Ronco in Seattle.
For the past year and a half, people on Akutan have been taking a hovercraft to get to their airport on a different island. Now the Aleutians East Borough has made the switch to a helicopter as their new airport taxi. KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports that the change has been a relief for residents.
On a typical quiet day in February, Akutan's school bus had to do something unusual, yield to oncoming traffic, in this case to a helicopter.
The helicopter's here! Helicopter!
The helicopter!
The kids' teacher, Chip Sharp, was driving them to lunch on the other side of town when the helicopter came in for a landing. This was its second day in service. The students weren't the only ones excited about their new airport taxi. Sharp and others in town were more than ready to say goodbye to the old hovercraft.
I had my doubts with the helicopter, you know, but yesterday was a foggy day. It wasn't real windy, but I can almost guarantee that the hovercraft would not have went yesterday because of the fog. And the helicopter, you know, he didn't seem to mind.
Both vehicles come from the Aleutians East Borough, which is tasked with getting people from Akutan to the airport. The borough's community development director, Annie Bailey, works in Anchorage. She says at a cost of more than $3 million a year, the hovercraft wasn't sustainable. It only brought in about $350,000 in passenger and freight fees in 2013, according to borough records. Now, Bailey says they're contracting with Maritime Helicopters of Homer.
We anticipate it to be $1 million less, which is still not affordable, but it's more affordable.
For passengers, it costs exactly the same, $100 each way. The hovercraft could only run about 60% of the time. Plus, it took about half an hour to make the trip over. The helicopter does it in 5 minutes. Now, the chopper can't haul as much cargo. Outgoing hovercraft Captain Alan Burt thinks that'll be a problem.
To be honest, I think the hovercraft's the best thing for this place, but other than that, just because of our capabilities, our load-carrying capabilities.
But it seems like most Akutan residents are willing to make the trade-off. The biggest items can always be brought in on a barge, and the helicopter can carry some loads in a hanging sling. Pilot Todd Ingle and his mechanic, Ray Simpson, are up for that challenge. They were in Akutan until this past weekend, when they tagged out with another crew. Ingle's got almost a decade of experience, but he's never flown in the Aleutians.
You know, I'm going to keep my personal restrictions really conservative for the moment until I get familiar with the area. I have a family to go home to at the end of the day, so I'm not going to be pushing any limits, and, you know, it's not worth anybody's life for getting somebody somewhere.
They've been respecting those restrictions, but Ingle and Simpson have been keeping busy. In February, they spent their first day on the job dealing with a storage container full of packages left behind after the hovercraft service had ended the weekend before. There were medications, groceries, even Christmas presents that had been stuck there since the holidays.
So this was your first load of mail?
It's the first load of mail, yep.
How many do you have to go?
There's probably a good 6 or 7 more loads, maybe more.
Once he landed in Akutan, Ingle unpacked the bags and boxes from the helicopter's cabin. Ray Simpson and Postmaster Kay Bereskin, who is also Mayor Joe Bereskin's wife, loaded them into a pickup truck.
I didn't expect that much. I didn't expect you to be able to carry that much.
I like puzzles.
There were reasons to be skeptical about the helicopter. The Aleutians East Borough hadn't worked out fuel storage or permanent housing for the crew before they started running the service. Still, in its first week, borough records showed the chopper carried 44 passengers, 290 pounds of freight, and more than 11,000 pounds of mail. And that went a long way toward winning over locals like teacher Chip Sharp.
If what we've seen in the last day and a half is any sign of what's to come, I think we'll be fine.
Fine for now, but the helicopter's still too expensive to keep long term. That's the next challenge, even more daunting than trying to fly or hover over the Bering Sea. The challenge of connecting Accutane to its airport for good. Reporting from Accutane, I'm Annie Ropeek.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Voters in Alaska's largest city elected six municipal assembly seats last evening. But with thousands of absentee and early ballots still to be counted, the outcomes of some races may change. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Anchorage voters kept four out of five city assembly incumbents in their seats on Tuesday, but two races ended unpredictably by the time the polls closed and most of the votes were tallied up. In East Anchorage, challenger Pete Peterson upset incumbent Adam Trombley, taking nearly 42% of the vote. Trombley finished the night with 37%. While a third challenger for the District 5 seat, Mao Tosi, took 20%. Peterson was not shy about declaring victory Tuesday as supporters rallied around him at Election Central. Peterson said he'd worked hard for votes.
I've been out there talking to people since last October. You know, when you knock on people's doors and take time to listen to them, they appreciate it. And they get a chance to know you personally, as a person. It's not just an ad that they see on TV or an ad they hear on the radio or a piece of paper in the mail. They've actually met you, and I think that makes a big difference.
If the Peterson-Trombley race is close, the District 6 race is a real squeaker. Three candidates are vying for that South Anchorage seat to be vacated by a termed-out assemblyman. By Tuesday night's count, Bill Evans had 41% of the vote, while Bruce Doherty had just under 39%. The third candidate, Pete Nolan, has 19% of the vote. Anchorage voters also passed 8 out of 9 ballot propositions, a $5.5 million bond package aimed at library improvements and a ballpark relocation failed by a narrow margin. City election officials say the 6,000 outstanding ballots should be tallied next week. Official election results will be certified on April 15th. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, more than 200 village corporations were promised land in and around their communities. At a meeting of the Alaska Native Village CEOs Association in Anchorage this week, participants described the problems they're encountering with the contaminated lands that were conveyed to them. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes has more.
Alaska Native corporations say they've had to spend money cleaning up contaminated sites and battling federal and state agencies to try and get them to clean up the sites or to get them back into federal ownership. Brendan Kane, vice president and general counsel for the EAC Corporation, says current information is not available, but a 1998 report listed 650 contaminated sites that had been conveyed to village corporations. He says some of those have been cleaned up, but others have been discovered, and he estimates the number is still in the hundreds. He says the lands were conveyed to the corporations from a number of federal entities.
A lot of military contamination, formerly used defense sites, which are called FUDs, FAA sites, Federal Aviation Administration sites, former mining sites, old schools, BIA schools.
Kane says the types of contaminants found at the sites also varies.
Arsenic, mercury, heavy metals, petroleum products, PCBs, mercury.
Yeah. Anything else?
Pretty long list. Unexploded ordnances. I mean, that's a significant type of contamination that.
Cameron Leonard is senior environmental counsel at the Perkins Coie Law Firm, which has several village corporations as clients. He says even though the corporations were not the polluters, they now own the problems.
Well, the problem is very simple, that under state and federal law, there's a strict liability system where the owners of the land are liable even if they didn't create the problem, even if they didn't create the contamination. So these ANCSA corporations who acquire their land from the federal government find out later that they acquired legacy contamination. And because of the way the laws are written, they're liable for a problem they didn't create and a problem that, you know, is going to be expensive for them to cure.
And Leonard says trading or giving the land back to the federal agency that once owned it is not easy.
It's hard for the native corporations, once they've taken their full allotment of land, then to do an exchange of a parcel they've already accepted for a new parcel typically would take an act of Congress.
Kane says some of the former landowners have been more helpful than others.
Some of the federal entities have acknowledged their responsibility and they're sort of proactively cleaning up some of these sites.
David Anderson is senior vice president of the Natives of Kodiak Village Corporation. He says the company selected lands north of Kodiak and built 122 single-family residences on one side of Spruce Cape. He says they'd like to develop the other side of the Cape too, but can't.
We've had some tar pits and stuff that were buried by the military when they left there, that when this land was conveyed to us. We didn't understand the significance. I don't think anybody did when this land was first conveyed to anybody, the significance of the contamination that was left behind. And what we're looking at is most of it's been cleaned up through the superfunds there. And some of the contamination has gone down into the fractured rock and is never going to be wholly done and back in the way we'd like it.
Anderson says now that surface areas have been cleaned up, the corporation is working to figure out how it could build a hotel or otherwise develop the land.
Well, we're trying to get water from the city side there out to our property because we can't drill wells because of the depth of, we don't know how far that goes down and the contamination to the water there.
Village corporations are working with the Bureau of Land Management, the agency that conveyed the lands to them, and Alaska's congressional delegation on potential solutions. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ed Ronco in Seattle, Annie Ropeek in Accutan, and Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Get away and stay in AK at UAS Juneau, small enough that your professors know you by name, big enough for a vibrant campus community with a new residence hall opening fall of 2014. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.